This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Phoebe Judge. Ambassador Thomas Pickering's career in the Foreign Service spans more than four decades. He served as ambassador for the United States across the globe to Jordan, El Salvador, Israel, Nigeria, India, and the Russian Federation. From 1989 to 1992, he was the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. He's also served as Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, the department's third highest office. Recently, Ambassador Pickering led the State Department's panel's investigation into the 2012 attack in Benghazi. Ambassador Pickering speaks tonight at 5:30 at Duke's Sanford School of Public Policy, but first he joins me on today's show. Welcome, Ambassador Pickering.
Thank you, Phoebe. Nice to be with you.
You joined the Foreign Service decades ago, a long time ago. Why did you decide to pursue this career?
I was very interested in history. I love travel. I was interested in international relations, so going into the Foreign Service seemed to be a kind of natural evolution. I had spent some time thinking about it. It was about 5 years before I went in. I passed the exams and then did some time as a Fulbright student overseas and then went in the Navy and spent 3.5 years in the Navy. And then came out and went into the Foreign Service.
One of your earliest posts was as ambassador to Jordan in the 70s. What was the region like in that period?
It was right after the Yom Kippur-Ramadan War. And Henry Kissinger had just become Secretary of State. And we were in the midst of a serious effort to see whether, in fact, we could push ahead with the peace process. It preceded Jimmy Carter's effort at Camp David, but it resulted in some serious efforts at disengagement along the confrontation lines following the Yom Kippur War. And it began to open up the possibility of an Egyptian-Israeli peace agreement. I was in Jordan at that time as ambassador. And the Jordanians very much wanted to be part of this process. For reasons of their own, and Yitzhak Rabin was prime minister of Israel at the time, they did not want to give up any territory in the West Bank, even little slivers, to give the Jordanians an opportunity, in a sense, to speak for themselves as well as the Palestinians. And we weren't speaking to the PLO in those days, and so Jordan was seen as a kind of surrogate way of approaching a Palestinian-Israeli settlement. 7 years after I left Jordan, I was ambassador in Israel. And partway through that period, we opened up relations with the PLO when they agreed, in fact, to meet our conditions. And that changed the nature of the negotiating relationship, and it changed the nature of the possibilities for progress. We're still now in a situation where there is no deal, if I could put it that way, between Israel and the Palestinians. There is a peace agreement with Jordan, and there's quite a long-standing peace agreement with Egypt. And Secretary Kerry made a major effort. I still think the door can be open to that, but we're on the cusp of an interesting time. Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel is speaking today to AIPAC in Washington, and tomorrow to a joint session of Congress, mainly about Iran. But this has raised the question of serious differences between the U.S. and Israel, and maybe if you like, we can discuss those a little bit.
Yes, I mean, I'd like to talk about that, and certainly the position that people like the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations and President Obama and John Kerry, the Secretary of State, all find themselves right now trying to keep this relationship with Israel, a very strong relationship, going and prosperous while dealing with this other very big issue, the Iranian deal. What do you see as someone in that position right now? It seems like a hard line to toe.
It is. I followed since 2002. I left the government at the end of 2000. The whole question of Iran very closely with a small group of friends. And so we have watched very carefully. We made a lot of public recommendations, our group, as to where things should go. We're now engaged, the U.S. and its European and Russian and Chinese friends, with a negotiation with Iran for a comprehensive agreement. It's not clear yet whether that negotiation will succeed at the end of this month, which is the current deadline. But there are great hopes, and there are indications that real progress is being made. There are three outstanding issues. The question with Israel has been that Mr. Netanyahu, 2.5 years ago, when the first agreement with Iran was made, declared even before it was final, it was the worst agreement that could ever be made by any country. He didn't even know all the terms and conditions. He shut up about that. And in fact, within recent months, he wanted to avoid moving to another deal with Iran. He declared he was very satisfied with that deal. So Mr. Netanyahu has had a kind of dynamic impression of what's going on here. Much of what Mr. Netanyahu, I think, is motivated by, and I've known him for a number of years, has been that his primary interest has been to preserve his role in Israel as prime minister and stay in office. And that's in some ways promoted by his ability to reach out to the right wing in Israel. And Israelis, at times of uncertainty, tend to move in conservative directions. It's not unnatural. They want to have somebody they can trust who is going to be cautious. So Mr. Netanyahu plays that role.
And there are some major elections coming up in Israel.
There is.
There
will be elections on the 17th of March. And, of course, this is even more complicated because we now have a split between the Democrats and the Republicans with respect to Mr. Netanyahu. All Republicans seemingly are in favor of his coming. Some Democrats are and some are not. And the president is obviously upset. The president has taken the view that during an Israeli political contest, the U.S. should stay out and not become, in one way or another, wrapped into the context. And we also have an election coming in the United States. And I always believe that in presidential elections, they begin literally the day before the balloting 4 years ahead. So we are already in an election period in the U.S., and Israel and the United States and their relationship has been up until now bipartisan. And Mr. Netanyahu's visit has a tendency now to show a split in U.S. support, at least for him. Certainly, I think the support for Israel remains strong, but Mr. Netanyahu and Mr. Obama have serious differences now.
So tomorrow, Netanyahu will speak to Congress on the invitation of John Boehner, the Republican leader. If you were in the position of still working in a diplomatic role, as you have been, as U.S. representative to the United Nations, what would you have said this morning in addressing all that's going on with this potential deal with Iran and with Netanyahu visiting and speaking? What would you have said?
Well, let me say what I think, and I'm freed of government constraints.
You can say anything.
So I'm trying to bring the accumulated knowledge and experience I have to the table. And my own view is that it is serious that there are differences between Prime Minister Netanyahu and Mr. Obama. It is very important, I believe, that we get a good agreement with Iran. That agreement will not be a perfect agreement. That is, Iran will not meet Mr. Netanyahu's desires, essentially, to have no nuclear program. We know that that's beyond the possibilities. But what Mr. Obama can get now is an agreement that could create a firewall between Iran's civil program and a military program and have adequate inspection and verification to monitor that carefully and to build a time period should Iran seek to break out. In my view, that is very much in the U.S. interests. The alternatives are pretty stark, and they usually end up with a military conflict with Iran. And I'm not sure, in fact, that Israel is ready itself to do that. Mr. Netanyahu is sort of talked hard line, but has always been, put it this way, ready to hold our coat while we take care of Iran militarily. And I'm sure that's not the answer to the problem at all. And there is no support in the United States, I think, for a military action against Iran, particularly if we have the ability to solve the problem in a reasonable way through a diplomatic negotiation. The good news is that Iran, without fault, has been characterized by the international inspectors as being scrupulously careful in agreeing with the agreement reached in 2013 in November. And so we have that to build on, and I think it's important. It is also important, finally, strategically in the region, to look ahead at the possibilities of bringing Iran into the international community, which is clearly what the new Iranian administration wants to do. Secondly, to exploit the areas of common interest in Afghanistan and Iraq. Iran is against Daesh, ISIL. Iran has been certainly against the Taliban in Afghanistan. So we have natural alliances if we can get over the huge burden of the differences over the nuclear program. So there's a lot out in there strategically in the region for us to look at as we go down the road here.
I wonder, though, when you have Prime Minister Netanyahu this morning, as he did, he put up a big map of Iran's reach into the world and kind of was targeting all of these different ways in which the country is a threat. And you have Secretary of State Kerry trying to say, we have to work with this. You know, how do you reconcile those two different of this kind of monstrous potential? And Secretary of State John Kerry saying in Switzerland, walking along a river, having these rather peaceful negotiations.
I think that to characterize it a little bit, if we were in Tehran and we were talking to some of the unalloyed radicals, they would have a similar map of how the U.S. has created this huge threat for them. Some of that is the natural evolution of 34 years of separation, distrust, reinforced by misunderstandings. And some of it is obviously a deep sense on the Iranian side that the American policy has been solely and only to change their governing regime, just as we have had this deep distrust of Iran to believe that their nuclear policy is solely and only to manufacture a nuclear weapon. We are now engaged in what I could call an exploration of the realities with each other to see whether, in fact, those are the home truths or whether they're merely the product of this separation, fear, mistrust, and misunderstanding. My own view is they're more the product of the latter, but there are things that each of us has done that each side would characterize as threatening. On their side, certainly the downing of the Iranian civil airliner in the Persian Gulf by an American naval ship, certainly the product of a serious mistake. But nevertheless, they saw that as a real attack against them. And our deep concern about things done in Iran, certainly before 2003, that looked very much like a nuclear weapons program to us.
With looking at both sides and seeing that both sides have their own arguments, there's so much distrust, public opinion distrust in this. Do you ever think that we can have collaboration, commonality with all of this? Is it too entrenched to ever be able to work together?
It's a notion that is naive to believe that diplomacy can settle every problem in the immediate future. But it is equally malevolent to believe that military action has been able to resolve those diplomatic problems. And it is true that in a number of them, a combination of force and pressure, sanctions, and diplomacy can produce a useful result. And my own view is that our military force is most useful when we don't have to deploy it, but it can be used to create the kind of leverage that is necessary to have productive diplomatic exchanges. This is not a naive view of the world, but in many ways, we are in an important position with the world's most effective military, with the world's still greatest and I think most expansive economy, and something we tend to forget with a country that is built on principles that most of the people in the world still admire and want to come here and enjoy the benefits of, despite the fact that I think over the last 10 or 12 years since 9/11, we have been in some cases very poor stewards of our principles, particularly in the way in which detainees and other people have been treated by the United States. And that's something that remains unfinished business. But it's important because those are the kinds of things that make us a natural leader in the world. And whenever a problem occurs, it is the foreign countries who come to us and say, what do you think and what do you want to do about the problem? I'd like us to have more opportunity to say to them, what do you think and how do you want to deal with this particular problem? Because it's through that collaborative relationship rather than the notion that we have all problems already resolved, have figured out every answer, and all they have to do is to buy our copybook to be safe, sound, prosperous, and healthy.
I'm speaking with Ambassador Thomas Pickering today on the state of things. My question is about the way in which, as you say, if diplomacy shouldn't always be used as the measure before military force in a perfect world. You know, we have this in our pocket, but we hope speaking and talks and listening to what people want can come first. How does diplomacy is impacted or directed by public opinion? How do you actually take that and put it forth?
But it's very important that as you look at diplomacy, it cannot be kind of some disembodied out there activity of a few people. It has to represent a national consensus, and that it is up to the executive branch in particular that has responsibility for conducting diplomacy to build that consensus. It is also true that we as a country are products of our own history, of our own way of thinking, of our own prejudices, and of our own mistakes. And we have a problem. We have a tendency to want to be hasty problem solvers. We have a tendency to take care of home first, which is not unimportant, and it's real, and it's part of being a good nation and a good state. We have a tendency of wanting to try somehow to ignore other peoples and problems if they become messy or unhappy. And we have a right to do that under some circumstances. But we always need to know that in a kind of increasingly tightly bound globe, things in small places overseas often tend to come back and affect us. We have a great propensity of short-term thinking and a real failure at long-term strategy, which we have to find a way to correct. And that's too bad. But it is the problem-solving, the American sense that we need to get things done in a hurry and that we have a capacity to do that, all of which is right, but all of which can sometimes lead you down dark alleys and bad places
if you're not careful about it.
Trying
to be a diplomat in America might be a little bit harder than trying to do this in another country where people are a little bit calmer.
That may be. And also, I think, because of our role in the world, inevitable as it is, and I think it is inevitable, and I think it's a role of responsibility, we have to carry on our back extra burdens from time to time. But it doesn't mean that in somehow we have been endorsed to give a diktat to everybody. It means we have been endorsed because people trust us still, and we can be smart leaders. And I worry in a number of circumstances where we tend to get too short-sighted.
My guest this hour is Ambassador Thomas Pickering. We'll talk more about the challenges of diplomacy and his long career just ahead. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Phoebe Judge. My guest today is Ambassador Thomas Pickering. He served all over the globe as U.S. ambassador. In 1989, he became the United States ambassador to the United Nations. And in 1997, he became Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs. During this long career of yours, you've been all over the world, posted in some positions that were very difficult and challenging. We spoke about going to Jordan and also Israel. You were serving in Nigeria in the early 1980s when President Reagan decided to appoint you as ambassador to El Salvador. This was a very tumultuous time in that country. Will you talk about that selection and what was going through your mind at the time when you got that phone call?
Well, it came at a very surprising time. I'd been in Nigeria 2 years. I was actually visiting London for minor medical treatment, and I got a call late in the day when the treatment was over from the Deputy Secretary of State saying that they'd like to have me go to El Salvador, and it was a very startling surprise. I had studied Spanish some years before but never used it. And I said, you know, I think probably given where I am, I'd rather stay where I am. And the conversation ended there.
Can you do that? Can you say no thank you?
Well, I knew I couldn't say no thank you finally. And so I said to my wife, who was in the room with me, I said, if they really want me, Larry Eagleburger, who was an old friend and who was the senior foreign service officer in the State Department at the time, he had the undersecretary of political affairs job. I said, I'll hear from Larry in half an hour. And in 10 minutes, I heard from Larry. And I said to Larry, this is a really messy proposition. Before I take this job, I'd like to talk to Secretary Shultz about how he sees it. I don't want to go into a job where my ideas and his ideas are so calamitously different that, in fact, I'm going to end up making a bigger mess. And he said, your tickets are at the embassy. We all think alike. So I went over and I talked to George Shultz, and he was terrific. The first thing he said to me is, you don't have to take this job and it will hold nothing against you. He's a great negotiator. But we sat and talked for an hour and a half about the job, and he and I totally agreed on what should be done. And I said, if you'll support me, I'm your man. He said, yes. And he said, come with me. And we went immediately to the White House. There was a big controversy about who should get this job. The White House had their own candidates. And President Reagan came in a lower door, and we were sitting there. And Secretary Shultz took me over, and he says, this is the next ambassador to El Salvador, John Pickering. And I shook the president's hand, and he said, I'm delighted that you're going to take the job. And that was it. And George Shultz said, don't move. Come with me. And we went to the State Department, and 10 minutes later, he introduced me to the press corps. So clearly, George Shultz wanted to get this job, and he knew that it was a difficult problem.
Were you quickly just set up what was going on in El Salvador at
the time?
Well,
I knew. I had followed it even from the remoteness of Nigeria. But then I had time in Washington. You always do, because I had to be confirmed by the Senate. And I had time to study to get my Spanish back, because the day I arrived in El Salvador, I had to give a press conference in Spanish. So it was really off to the races. I never regretted going. It was dangerous. But I thought that in many ways, I was given a unique opportunity to get some things done that I thought could make a difference. Dealing with the human rights violations, getting the military conflict under control.
Yes, and let's just
then looking forward to a peace process that evolved.
And what was happening at that time in El Salvador? You had two different groups that were at each other's throats. Will you talk a little bit about what was going on with the military government and
well,
we had
more than two. We had first there were five guerrilla organizations loosely bound together, conducting their own activities, mainly in northern El Salvador and, to some cases, infiltrating other areas. There were, on the government side, a series of police forces and military forces. And there was behind the scenes, run by the conservatives in El Salvador, many arch-conservatives, death squads. And so we had to clean up the death squads. And George Bush was vice president, came down and did a magnificent job at our suggestion in telling the Salvadorans that if they didn't clean up the death squads, he told the military this in a small meeting I attended, if they didn't clean up the death squads, neither he nor George, nor Ronald Reagan could keep the assistance coming. It was really tough talk, and it was right. We started to retrain Salvadoran military, and we had to do that in Honduras. There was an election, which then led to the election of Napoleon Duarte, a Christian Democrat, as the freely elected president of El Salvador, who did an enormous job. And then he started peace negotiations, which actually had their final stage when I was ambassador at the UN, and they took place at the UN. So I and a number of members of my staff actually participated on the side in the final stages of the Salvadoran peace negotiations a number of years later. So it was a very interesting time. We kept contact with many different people in El Salvador. We certainly had to contend with everything from liberation theology people on one end of the spectrum and very hard right conservatives who in one way or another may have been linked with death squads.
But there was also a very violent time, and there were safety threats against you. What was it like trying to operate in that type of a situation?
Well, you in those kinds of situations have to look out for security. I had to look out for security not only for myself but the whole embassy, and I of course had much more security than the rest of the embassy. So it was a double problem, and we had to be careful. Before I had arrived, embassy people had been killed. After I left, four Marines were killed, unfortunately eating outdoors in a restaurant where they shouldn't have been. And so it was dangerous. They provided, State Department provided security for me. There were threats against me that one way or another we attempted to take care of, but it was never easy or comfortable. And you just learn to take the appropriate security precautions and hope that they're adequate.
And Jesse Helms actually was calling for your removal as this was all going on. What was that experience like, trying to operate in this in that country and do the best you could?
Well, there was no question at all that he did. I don't think that there was ever anything serious on the part of either the president or the secretary of state to bow to any of that pressure. I came back and briefed the Congress. When I went to my next job after El Salvador, I had separate private hearings with Senator Helms about El Salvador. He had hundreds of questions. The really interesting thing was that I answered his questions. He never had really a carefully thought out idea about how to follow up the questions. He had just had a list of questions. And I had been in El Salvador and worked there. If I couldn't answer his questions, I didn't deserve to go on to another job.
So it was rather just political theater, maybe.
So that a lot of that, I think, was basically part of his own effort to ensure that he remained front and center in the American press and in the public mind and perhaps down here in North Carolina.
So do you feel that your time in El Salvador was successful for all that it was?
Well, I think we had a number of successes, and I think that those have helped to change the situation, but no one is uniquely father to success. On the other hand, it is often a public perception that one person becomes very responsible for failures. And so I think that we made mistakes. We always do. But I think we did a number of things well and a number of things right, and things came together. And that led overall to a peace settlement in 1991 in El Salvador, which has given Salvador a new a lease on life. Unfortunately, subsequently, the United States deported large numbers of Salvadorans in the United States associated with gang activities, which has meant that the country is under a new domestic threat of criminal gangs closely cooperating with Mexico narco traffickers, and we have a new problem, and it's a serious problem.
A very violent problem.
There's a violence problem. There's a gang problem. There's a destabilizing problem, which is really, I think, tragic for El Salvador. And to some extent, we should have thought before, in fact, we sent all these people back home as to what it might create in Salvador and help them get themselves in a position to deal with it. They cannot yet deal with it effectively, even though we have provided some assistance and probably will provide more.
What is that like to spend a life, a career, given these 2-year, 4-year stints in a post, caring about it, devoting everything to it, and then being told, you know, you're moving on, you're going to the next, but still having all of these thoughts about what's happening and having to look back?
You get to understand that after a time, it's an opportunity for new ideas. You get to understand that it is not in the interest of your country that you become the primary advocate for a foreign country in the United States. It is true that too short a time leaves you short-sighted and unfamiliar, and as a result, less effective in supporting U.S. interests. And so the whole question of how much time you spend is a subject that continues to be of some controversy. George Shultz, his secretary, thought that 3 years was about right. And I think he is truly correct in that. I spent slightly over 3 years in a number of places. I think if you spend a longer time, perhaps then you're closing the door to somebody else who can bring a different perspective, new insight, maybe a set of different ideas that will be important.
You've spoken out about the fact that many of the diplomatic positions, not many of them, but a portion of them still to this day are given as, I want to say rewards or favors. I don't think that that's right, but they're appointed by the president sometimes to people who may not have great experience in the country or anything like it. Can you talk a little bit about your thoughts about the way in which diplomatic posts are given today?
Yeah, Phoebe, traditionally a third of American ambassadorial posts have been the province for the appointment by the White House. And many too many of those have, in fact, been given in return for campaign contributions. Speak frankly, that's the reality. Selling offices is against the law in the United States. Why the White House should have that opportunity, whether it's Republican or Democratic, to get by with it with impunity is, in my view, a failure to observe their public obligations. Secondly, my own view is that professionals who prepare for a long period of time have a better opportunity to make a more significant contribution than people who jump in from outside. But I am not of the opinion that nobody from outside is at all qualified. And I can think back in the John F. Kennedy administration, and his appointments of ambassadors were quite remarkable in a sense that he found some of the best people in the country to do the job, and they did a magnificent job. So I think most of my professional colleagues and I join in believing that it's those kinds of people that ought to be appointed, and they ought not to be appointed because they gave a large amount of money to a political campaign. There ought to be better ways to raise money for political campaigns. And a large number of people who are so appointed turn out to be less than good for all kinds of reasons. Disinterest, they merely want the title, they like the idea of living abroad. Most of those jobs are in smaller Western European places where it's comfortable to live. Maybe they can do less harm there. Certainly, they're all assisted by professional staffs. And some of them argue, well, we have a personal relationship with the president. We can call him when we need to. That's not trivial, but it, in my view, is not something that's overwhelmingly important in doing the job. My own sense is that Al Gore, when he was a senator from Tennessee years ago, suggested rather than 30% or 33%, maybe 10% should be from the outside. And this would give the president an opportunity to appoint people who were really distinguished and were the kinds of folks that we would all respect and could do the job and bring in that outside capacity, which I think in the end is important for an effective diplomacy, but not overstretching it to be selling jobs for campaign contributions.
I only have a minute or so left, but I want to talk about one of the biggest items that you've worked on in the past few years, and that is in the investigation into what happened in Benghazi,
sure,
the embassy. How did you approach that, and were you happy with the results?
Yes, we approached it because there were a group of five of us who worked closely together. We approached it that we would examine everything we could possibly find, that we had no preconceived views, and that we would carry out the mandate of Congress, which was to look at four or five major elements. Was it a security issue? Was it a surprise? What were the elements that led to the problem? And who was responsible for it? And particularly in the latter, it was the Congress itself in the legislation that established these kinds of reviews that said, please don't go and pick the top official who has, as a result of their obligations of office, officially taken responsibility. Go look down at the people who actually made the decisions and the people who reviewed those decisions. And that's what we did. And so the people we identified in our view as having responsibilities, we could do nothing further except to identify them and say why, were the people who we believed carried those responsibilities. Some of them, they were overworked. Some of them were much too much breadth of authority. Some of them had too much to do. They're all good reasons, perhaps, but they led to tragedy. And with tragedy, you're obliged to take steps to avoid having it happen again. And this was our view, that if we could make a contribution to change, which would avoid having these kinds of things happen again, it was important to do so. Finally, we also had a very clear view that the perfect security for American diplomats is to stay locked up in some kind of fortress. And we very much said that cannot happen and that risks have to be taken. And that's what people are paid for and hired for. They can't be foolish risks, and they can't be risks taken as a result of oversight and poor support. But in that context, it is important for Foreign Service officers to do their job, to get out and be around and see people in the country where they're accredited.
Well, we're running out of time. I want to thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Phoebe. Yeah.
Ambassador Thomas Pickering. Ambassador Pickering will speak tonight at Duke Sanford School at 5:30 p.m. More details on our website, thestateofthings.org. That's The State of Things for today. The State of Things is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadu Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is the technical director. Jess Clark is our intern. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Phoebe Judge.